Thus we see that no line can be drawn between the powers of sense and of reflection, they pass imperceptibly into one another. We may indeed distinguish between the seeing and the closed eye, between the sensation and the recollection of it. But this distinction carries us a very little way, for recollection is present in sight as well as sight in recollection. There is no impression of sense which does not simultaneously recall differences of form, number, color, and the like. Neither is such a distinction applicable at all to our internal bodily sensations, which give no sign of themselves when unaccompanied with pain, and even when we are most conscious of them, have often no assignable place in the human frame. Who can divide the nerves or great nervous centers from the mind which uses them? Who can separate the pains and pleasures of the mind from the pains and pleasures of the body? The words inward and outward, active and passive, mind and body, are best conceived by us as differences of degree passing into differences of kind, and at one time, and under one aspect acting in the harmony, and then again opposed. They introduce a system and order into the knowledge of our being, and yet, like many other general terms, are often in advance of our actual analysis or observation. According to some writers, the inward sense is only the fading away or imperfect realization of the outward. But this leaves out of sight one half of the phenomenon, for the mind is not only withdrawn from the world of sense, but introduced to a higher world of thought and reflection, in which, like the outward sense, she is trained and educated. By use, the outward sense becomes keener and more intense, especially when confined within narrow limits. The savage with little or no thought has a quicker discernment of the track than the civilized man. In like manner, the dog, having the help of scent as well as of sight, is superior to the savage. By use again, the inward thought becomes more defined and distinct. What was at first an effort is made easy by the natural instrumentality of language, and the mind learns to grasp universals with no more exertion than is required for the sight of an outward object. There is a natural connection and arrangement of them, like the association of objects in a landscape. Just as a note or two of music suffices to recall a whole piece to the musician's or composer's mind, so a great principle or leading thought suggests and arranges a world of particulars. The power of reflection is not feebler than the faculty of sense, but of a higher and more comprehensive nature. It not only receives the universals of sense, but gives them a new content by comparing and combining them with one another. It withdraws from the seen that it may dwell in the unseen. The sense only presents us with a flat and impenetrable surface. The mind takes the world to pieces and puts it together on a new pattern. The universals which are detached from sense are reconstructed in science. They are not the mere impressions of sense, are the truth of the world in which we live. And, as an argument to those who will only believe what they can hold in their hands, we may further observe that they are the source of our power over it. To say that the outward sense is stronger than the inward is like saying that the arm of the workman is stronger than the constructing or directing mind. Returning to the senses, we may briefly consider two questions. First, their relation to the mind. Secondly, their relation to outward objects. 1. The senses are not merely holes set in a wooden horse, but instruments of the mind with which they are organically connected. There is no use of them without some use of words, some natural or latent logic, some previous experience or observation. Sensation, like all other mental processes, is complex and relative, though apparently simple. The senses mutually confirm and support one another. It is hard to say how much our impressions of hearing may be affected by those of sight, or how far our impressions of sight may be corrected by the touch, especially in infancy. The confirmation of them by one another cannot, of course, be given by any one of them. Many intuitions which are inseparable from the act of sense are really the result of complicated reasonings. The most cursory glance at objects enables the experienced eye to judge approximately of their relations and distance. Although nothing is impressed on the retina except color, including gradations of light and shade, from these delicate and almost imperceptible differences we seem, chiefly to derive our ideas of distance and position. By comparison of what is near with what is distant, we learn that the tree, house, river, and sea which are a long way off are objects of a like nature with those which are seen by us in our immediate neighborhood, although the actual impression made on the eye is very different in one case and in the other. This is a language of large and small letters, slightly differing in form and exquisitely graduated by distance, which we are learning all our life long, and which we attain in various degrees according to our powers of sight or observation. There is another consideration. The greater or less strain upon the nerves of the eye or ear is communicated to the mind and silently informs a judgment. We have also the use, not of one eye only, but of two, which give us a wide range, and help us to discern, by the greater or less acuteness of the angle which the rays of sight form, the distance of an object and its relation to other objects. But we are already passing beyond the limits of our actual knowledge on a subject which has given rise to many conjectures. More important than the addition of another conjecture is the observation, whether in the case of sight, or of any other sense, of the great complexity of the causes, and the great simplicity of the effect. The sympathy of the mind and the ear is no less striking than the sympathy of the mind and the eye. Do we not seem to perceive instinctively and as an act of sense the differences of articulate speech, and of musical notes? Yet how small a part of speech, or of music is produced by the impression of the ear compared with that which is furnished by the mind. Again, the more refined faculty of sense, as in animals, so also in man, seems often to be transmitted by inheritance. Neither must we forget that in the use of the senses, as in his whole nature, man is a social being, who is always being educated by language, habit, and the teaching of other men as well as by his own observation. He knows distance, because he is taught it by a more experienced judgment than his own. He distinguishes sounds, because he is told to remark them by a person of a more discerning ear. And as we inherit from our parents, or other ancestors, peculiar powers of sense or feeling, so we improve and strengthen them, not only by regular teaching, but also by sympathy and communion with other persons. 2. The second question, namely, that concerning the relation of the mind to external objects, is really a trifling one, though it has been made the subject of a famous philosophy. We may, if we like, with Berkeley, resolve objects of sense into sensations, but the change is one of name only, and nothing is gained, and something is lost by such a resolution or confusion of them. For we have not really made a single step towards idealism, and any arbitrary inversion of our ordinary modes of speech is disturbing to the mind. The youthful metaphysician is delighted at his marvelous discovery that nothing is, and that what we see or feel is our sensation only. For a day or two the world has a new interest to him. He alone knows the secret which has been communicated to him by the philosopher, that mind is all, when in fact he is going out of his mind in the first intoxication of a great thought. But he soon finds that all things remain as they were, the laws of motion, the properties of matter, the qualities of substances. After having inflicted his theories on anyone who is willing to receive them, first on his father and mother, secondly on some other patient listener, thirdly on his dog, he finds that he only differs from the rest of mankind in the use of a word. He had once hoped that, by getting rid of the solidity of matter, he might open a passage to worlds beyond. He liked to think of the world as the representation of the divine nature, and delighted to imagine angels and spirits wandering through space, present in the room in which he is sitting without coming through the door, nowhere and everywhere at the same instant. At length he finds that he has been the victim of his own fancies. He has neither more nor less evidence of the supernatural than he had before. He himself has become unsettled, but the laws of the world remain fixed, as at the beginning. He has discovered that his appeal to the fallibility of sense was really an illusion. For whatever uncertainty there may be in the appearances of nature, arises only out of the imperfection or variation of the human senses, or possibly from the deficiency of certain branches of knowledge. When science is able to apply her tests, the uncertainty is at an end. We are apt sometimes to think that moral and metaphysical philosophy are lowered by the influence which is exercised over them by physical science. But any interpretation of nature by physical science is far in advance of such idealism. The philosophy of Berkeley, while giving unbounded license to the imagination, is still groveling on the level of sense. We may, if we please, carry the skepticism a step further and deny not only objects of sense, but the continuity of our sensations themselves. We may say with Protagoras and Hume that what is appears, and that what appears appears only to individuals, and to the same individual only at one instant. But then, as Plato asks, and we must repeat the question, what becomes of the mind? Experience tells us by a thousand proofs that our sensations of color, taste, and the like are the same as they were an instant ago, that the act which we are performing 1 minute is continued by us in the next, and also supplies abundant proof that the perceptions of other men are, speaking generally, the same or nearly the same with our own. After having slowly and laboriously in the course of ages gained a conception of the whole and parts, of the constitution of the mind, of the relation of man to God and nature, imperfect indeed, but the best we can, we are asked to return again to the beggarly elements of ancient skepticism, and acknowledge only atoms and sensations devoid of life or unity. Why should we not go a step further still, and doubt the existence of the senses, or of all things? We are but such stuff as dreams are made of, for we have left ourselves no instruments of thought by which we can distinguish man from the animals, or conceive of the existence even of a mollusk. And observe, this extreme skepticism has been allowed to spring up among us, not, like the ancient skepticism, in an age when nature and language really seem to be full of illusions, but in the 18th and 19th centuries, when men walk in the daylight of inductive sciences. The attractiveness of such speculations arises out of their true nature not being perceived. They are veiled in graceful language. They are not pushed to extremes. They stop where the human mind is disposed also to stop, short of a manifest absurdity. Their inconsistency is not observed by their authors, or by mankind in general, who are equally inconsistent themselves. They leave on the mind a pleasing sense of wonder and novelty. In youth they seem to have a natural affinity to one class of persons as poetry has to another, but in later life either we drift back into common sense, or we make them the starting points of a higher philosophy. We are often told that we should inquire into all things before we accept them. With what limitations is this true? For we cannot use our senses without admitting that we have them, or think without presupposing that there is in us a power of thought, or affirm that all knowledge is derived from experience without implying that this first principle of knowledge is prior to experience. The truth seems to be that we begin with the natural use of the mind, as of the body, and we seek to describe this as well as we can. We eat before we know the nature of digestion, we think before we know the nature of reflection. As our knowledge increases, our perception of the mind enlarges also. We cannot indeed get beyond facts, but neither can we draw any line which separates facts from ideas. And the mind is not something separate from them, but included in them, and they in the mind, both having a distinctness and individuality of their own. To reduce our conception of mind to a succession of feelings and sensations is like the attempt to view a wide prospect by inches through a microscope, or to calculate a period of chronology by minutes. The mind ceases to exist when it loses its continuity, which though far from being its highest determination, is yet necessary to any conception of it. Even an inanimate nature cannot be adequately represented as an endless succession of states or conditions. Section 2. Another division of the subject has yet to be considered. Why should the doctrine that knowledge is sensation in ancient times, or of sensationalism or materialism in modern times, be allied to the lower, rather than to the higher view of ethical philosophy? At first sight, the nature and origin of knowledge appear to be wholly disconnected from ethics and religion. Nor can we deny that the ancient Stoics were materialists, or that the materialist doctrines prevalent in modern times have been associated with great virtues, or that both religious and philosophical idealism have not unfrequently parted company with practice. Still, upon the whole, it must be admitted that the higher standard of duty has gone hand in hand with the higher conception of knowledge. It is Protagoras who is seeking to adapt himself to the opinions of the world. It is Plato who rises above them, the one maintaining that all knowledge is sensation, the other basing the virtues on the idea of good. The reason of this phenomenon has now to be examined by those who rest knowledge immediately upon sense. That explanation of human action is deemed to be the truest which is nearest to sense. As knowledge is reduced to sensation, so virtue is reduced to feeling, happiness or good to pleasure. The different virtues, the various characters which exist in the world, are the disguises of self-interest. Human nature is dried up, there is no place left for imagination, or in any higher sense for religion. Ideals of a whole, or of a state, or of a law of duty, or of a divine perfection, are out of place in an Epicurean philosophy. The very terms in which they are expressed are suspected of having no meaning. Man is to bring himself back as far as he is able to the condition of a rational beast. He is to limit himself to the pursuit of pleasure, but of this, he is to make a far-sighted calculation. He is to be rationalized, secularized, animalized, or he is to be an amiable skeptic, better than his own philosophy, and not falling below the opinions of the world. Imagination has been called that busy faculty which is always intruding upon us in the search after truth. But imagination is also that higher power by which we rise above ourselves and the commonplaces of thought and life. The philosophical imagination is another name for reason finding an expression of herself in the outward world. To deprive life of ideals is to deprive it of all higher and comprehensive aims, and of the power of imparting and communicating them to others. For men are taught, not by those who are on a level with them, but by those who rise above them, who see the distant hills, who soar into the empyrean. Like a bird in a cage, the mind confined to sense is always being brought back from the higher to the lower, from the wider to the narrower view of human knowledge. It seeks to fly but cannot. Instead of aspiring towards perfection, it hovers about this lower world and the earthly nature. It loses the religious sense which more than any other seems to take a man out of himself. Weary of asking what is truth, it accepts the blind witness of eyes and ears. It draws around itself the curtain of the physical world and is satisfied. The strength of a sensational philosophy lies in the ready accommodation of it to the minds of men. Many who have been metaphysicians in their youth, as they advance in years, are prone to acquiesce in things as they are, or rather appear to be. They are spectators, not thinkers, and the best philosophy is that which requires of them the least amount of mental effort. As a lower philosophy is easier to apprehend than a higher, so a lower way of life is easier to follow, and therefore such a philosophy seems to derive a support from the general practice of mankind. It appeals to principles which they all know and recognize. It gives back to them in a generalized form the results of their own experience. To the man of the world they are quintessence of his own reflections upon life. To follow custom, to have no new ideas or opinions, not to be straining after impossibilities, to enjoy today with just so much forethought as is necessary to provide for the morrow, this is regarded by the greater part of the world as the natural way of passing through existence. And many who have lived thus have attained to a lower kind of happiness or equanimity. They have possessed their souls in peace without ever allowing them to wander into the region of religious or political controversy, and without any care for the higher interests of man. But nearly all the good, as well as some of the evil, which has ever been done in this world has been the work of another spirit, the work of enthusiasts and idealists, of apostles and martyrs. The leaders of mankind have not been of the gentle Epicurean type. They have personified ideas. They have sometimes also been the victims of them. But they have always been seeking after a truth, or ideal of which they fell short, and have died in a manner disappointed of their hopes, that they might lift the human race out of the slough in which they found them. They have done little compared with their own visions and aspirations, but they have done that little, only because they sought to do, and once perhaps thought, that they were doing, a great deal more. The philosophies of Epicurus or Hume give no adequate, or dignified conception of the mind. There is no organic unity in a succession of feeling or sensations, no comprehensiveness in an infinity of separate actions. The individual never reflects upon himself as a whole. He can hardly regard one act or part of his life as the cause or effect of any other act or part. Whether in practice or speculation, he is to himself only in successive instance. To such thinkers, whether in ancient or in modern times, the mind is only the poor recipient of impressions, not the heir of all the ages, or connected with all other minds. It begins again with its own modicum of experience, having only such vague conceptions of the wisdom of the past as are inseparable from language and popular opinion. It seeks to explain from the experience of the individual what can only be learned from the history of the world. It has no conception of obligation, duty, conscience. These are to the Epicurean or utilitarian philosopher only names which interfere with our natural perceptions of pleasure and pain. There seem then to be several answers to the question, why the theory that all knowledge is sensation is allied to the lower, rather than to the higher view of ethical philosophy. First, because it is easier to understand and practice. Secondly, because it is fatal to the pursuit of ideals, moral, political, or religious. Thirdly, because it deprives us of the means and instruments of higher thought, of any adequate conception of the mind, of knowledge, of conscience, of moral obligation. On the nature and limits of psychology. Since the above essay first appeared, many books on psychology have been given to the world, partly based upon the views of Herbert and other German philosophers, partly independent of them. The subject has gained in bulk and extent. Whether it has had any true growth is more doubtful. It begins to assume the language and claim the authority of a science, but it is only an hypothesis or outline, which may be filled up in many ways according to the fancy of individual thinkers. The basis of it is a precarious one. Consciousness of ourselves and a somewhat uncertain observation of the rest of mankind. Its relations to other sciences are not yet determined. They seem to be almost too complicated to be ascertained. It may be compared to an irregular building, run up hastily, and not likely to last, because its foundations are weak, and in many places rest only on the surface of the ground. It has sought rather to put together scattered observations, and to make them into a system than to describe or prove them. It has never severely drawn the line between facts and opinions. It has substituted a technical phraseology for the common use of language, being neither able to win acceptance for the one, nor to get rid of the other.